Hey, everybody, thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show, episode number 101. We have two lovely sponsors this week, Environments for Humans, who are promoting their Responsive Web Design Summit. That's at rwdsummit.com. Coming up the first couple of days of April, use coupon code SHOPTALKSHOW for 20% off those tickets. And Perch, CMS, a really nice CMS that Rachel Andrew works on, who we had on a previous show. Check that out at grabaperch.com. We'll tell you more about both of those things later in the show, but for now, let's kick things off.
Welcome to the 101st episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about sound effects and front-end web design and development. I'm Dave Rupert, and with me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.
Chris,
thank you.
Who do we have today?
Mr. John Resig. Thanks for joining us, John.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Lovely.
Great.
So John is a co-worker of Pamela, who we had on. You guys both work, it just so happens, at the Khan Academy.
Yes, absolutely. Right. Yeah, fantastic nonprofit. Yeah, I love them. I will go on forever. But yeah, I mean, our big thing is that
we should. Can you go on for half of one forever about it temporarily?
I mean, it's just, yeah, like our big thing is that, you know, we want to bring education to everyone, everywhere for free. We're covering lots of different stuff, but, you know, we have like math and science and art history and medicine. And I focus a lot on the computer science stuff along with Pamela.
Right. So if anybody in the world, so long as they have access to a computer with internet access, can go to khanacademy.org and specifically for computer science /CS, and just get started. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Absolutely.
Cool. So what would be like day one of that experience? What's the onboarding of like learning computer programming through Khan Academy?
Well, I mean, so we take a couple approaches. One is we have a lot of curriculum, and our curriculum is all designed to use JavaScript and processing. So what we do is we take the processing API. For those of you who aren't familiar, it's a basic, you know, graphics layer. So you can do all sorts of, draw a rectangle, fill the color red, you know, stuff like that. And a long time ago, back in like, I think 2008, I ported processing over to JavaScript called processing.js.
From what? From something else?
So it's normally Java. It's its own little, Java environment. Mm-hmm. And so I ported that over. And then, at least with this platform, what we're doing is we're using the processing API. So you can call rect and ellipse and all that stuff. But the code you're writing is JavaScript. So it's not using the Java code that you would normally use in writing processing. So all our curriculum is it's all very like, okay, here is, an introduction to what is programming. You know, this is what, start with function calls and variables and loops and et cetera, et cetera. And at the moment we have up through like object oriented programming. So this is what Pamela is working on. We have, like, we have challenges. We have that kind of get you working with the fundamentals of the language. We have, videos, and we have like talk throughs and all sorts of different ways to get you engaged and to help make sure that you're actually learning something.
Was that the idea behind processing, is that it's kind of engaging because it's so visual and stuff?
Yes, exactly. So I went through a number of iterations of the platform. So like I started working on this, I guess, late 2011, and I went through a number of different prototypes, and the initial prototypes were all text-based. So a lot of the very basic, like, intro to computer programming stuff out there, like, what you frequently see is like, okay, let's start to program and let's do a function.
This is foo.
Five. Or let's make a function that, like, prints out, like, the Fibonacci sequence or something.
Yeah. And like,
oh, I hear that doesn't work in Node, though. Okay, go on. Go ahead.
So, I mean, like, that stuff like that really, really bothers me, though, because what that's doing is the only thing that that's doing is it's finding people who like that sort of logic challenge. And what it's not doing is this, what I want to do is I want to find people and get them excited about programming in relation to the things they're already excited about in their life. So finding ways in which mm-hmm. programming can help them do, to do science, to do humanities work, to do health, to do all, whatever it is that's your thing, finding ways to make programming more a part of that. And the thing is, though, is that most programming curriculum out there, they're teaching you just to be a programmer who likes code for the sake of coding, which is fine, which is totally fine. I'm that. I will love the code for as long as I love, for as long as I can. Right. But the thing is, like, I don't feel like we need more of that. We need more of the other thing. I feel like with the goal with what I'm with the platform is more. I don't want to turn out a whole bunch of people who are going to be working at startups. That would be fine. I mean, I'm not condemning it. Mm-hmm. However, I would be much more excited if we turned out a whole bunch of people who are now doing their jobs, whatever that may be, but can now think in a programmatic way and have that little bit of leg up such that, if you have a biologist who is like, doing things with DNA, it is no longer just like, oh, I have this stuff. What do I do? Do I just like sit down and like tabulate all the like, bits of the genome? No, you'd be like, okay, well, this is something a computer can do for me and they can make my life a lot easier. And, it turns sort of these impossible tasks into something that's possible. And that's something that I'm really excited about.
Yeah, that's just, it's poetry, sir.
It's bringing programming to the masses in a way, not just bringing more programming to people who are already inclined to program.
Exactly. That's what I hope to achieve with this platform. And that's what I aspire to.
I'm a pretty visual person and I've tried to learn Canvas for a long time and I was just like not grokking it. And so I signed up for Khan Academy actually, even though I know JavaScript. And I was just like, I'm just going to go through a little Khan Academy. And I started, drawing Canvas and I started understanding how it's kind of weird and really linear. And, it was great. Really? It was very successful for me. I feel like I walked away knowing how to draw on a canvas.
Yeah.
Process.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's like, I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what it is exactly the difference between, learning between, doing a graphical output versus a textual one. But I think sort of just inherently graphical output is just simply more interesting. There's a reason why a lot of like introductory programming curriculums, it's interesting because I say programming, but the thing is what they start with is like HTML. And mm-hmm. so like I visited an all girls, school in California at middle school. And the first thing that they teach them, one of the first things they teach them is HTML because one, you can see the output. There's a direct connection between like what you type produces some output and you can see that precisely. But it has the second side effect, which is, the concept of like syntax and the fact that syntax matters, that you're communicating something to a computer and the way in which you write it and the order in which you write it is very, there are rules. And this is something that's very different. Like most people don't have to deal with this. If you're chatting with a friend, you can type whatever in the box and your friend can decipher it. Whereas like, if you are now trying to tell this to a computer, And if you're trying to write HTML and instead of doing a less than sign, you do some other symbol, or if you put extra spaces in or who knows what, it's going to look weird. And, this is the sort of thing that, it's one of those skills that's like something you don't really think about, but for someone who's just starting and is really young, it's something that is just not really well understood.
That's nice. HTML is like a decent kind of onboarding computer language.
Yeah. I mean, and I think the thing is that a lot of people get caught up in sort of like, oh, well, HTML isn't code, or, you know, it's not programming, which you know, it absolutely is not programming. It's not a Turing complete anything. However, it's able to, yeah, get you part of the way there. So at the moment on the Khan Academy website, we don't have any HTML. Curriculum. But it is something that we're hoping to do here. So we'll have that in addition to the JavaScript and processing and other, pieces of curriculum that we might have.
I like that. My favorite part about that is that when you're done with a bit of HTML, that it can like come with you. You can like save it and use it later. Whereas I feel like sometimes these little, like I'm working in this specialized little environment and I'm typing code and it works. But when I go home tonight, I don't have access to that same computer that had that same stuff on or whatever. That's kind of how I felt in college, that like I don't, these things that I'm writing like only work in this particular special dev environment thing. Whereas HTML just works everywhere. I don't know.
Yeah, that is a huge advantage for sure.
Yeah, I'd never really thought that like it's super HTML and CSS are super valuable for just engaging that like that syntactical part of your brain. Like syntax matters now.
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that's been very eye-opening for me as I've been working on the curriculum and sort of the platform here is finding all the ways in which students don't understand what is going on. And I mean, because the problem is that like, I feel like probably for a lot of us, like it's been a long time since we learned how to program. And additionally, it's probably, we were probably learning it later in life, maybe. Whereas like, for example, like, you know, in my case, you know, teaching it to middle school and younger, there are lots of like particular problems there that, you know, I may not have, you know, encountered when I started to learn how to program when I was like 15. Like there's a pretty big chasm between like a 15-year-old learning to program versus like a 10-year-old learning to program. Which I also think is pretty interesting. Just like sort of basics of like, you know, like how they think and how they're able to type and like how small their fingers are and how they can't, and like, you know, they don't really understand, you know, basic keyboard mechanics and mouse things. And like, it's just like, there's like lots of like little weird things like that where you just don't really even have to think about that.
Yeah. So, so you can identify those things through somehow at the Khan Academy. Like if somebody's struggling or they don't get what you're trying to do, you hear about that somehow? Are you?
Yeah. I mean, so a couple things that we do is one is we do a bunch of in-person testing. So like actually going with students and in a classroom and seeing how they interact with the software. So the first summer where we were developing this is during 2012, we ran at Khan Academy, we ran a summer school. And so this was all kids 6th to 8th grade, if I remember, or 5th to 8th grade. And in this, one of the things we taught was computer programming. So this is actually before we even released the platform. We had students and we would take them and send them to class and we would have them try it. And we'd be sitting there and be like, okay, you need to follow these instructions. And at the end, you're going to be drawing a character. And you need to have this and you need to animate it. And we had it all very clearly laid out. So we thought. And then we would watch the students interact with this and see how they responded. And it was very, very eye-opening. Like, we just found so many issues because we had error reporting, for example, that was hooked into JS Hint. So, like, anytime you had syntax errors, it'd be like, oh, it looks, you know, you're missing a semicolon or, you know, stuff like that. And instantly we found that the errors were like, well, I mean, we kind of knew this, but like, it was like very obvious just that the errors were just really, really not good. So like, we had to put a ton of work into doing better error reporting, making it much clearer to the student what's going wrong, what specifically is going wrong, like what they were expecting to do versus what is actually happening, stuff like that. And so it was, that was a huge challenge. It's just that, you know, as a developer, you it's all this terminology that's baked in that you know what those terms mean, and you kind of just expect that other people do, and it's a lot of work to bridge that gap.
Yeah, I could see that. Was did you like, find that they like stopped in their tracks, kind of, if they have a, you know, if there's a, you know, if, I don't know, they're trying to get from A to B, animate the left leg forward 6 pixels or whatever, and they forget a semicolon. Would that be like, is that like a moment of panic and I don't know. I guess I don't know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, but I mean, there at least there are certain things. One is that there are challenges from a syntactical understanding the constructs you see on the screen level. And then there is sort of the logical leaps they have to make. Going from, doing no programming, you know, and simply like drawing on the screen. That is sort of the basic level. The next step is, okay, instead of drawing on the screen, turning those into function calls. So you're saying, okay, I'm drawing a rectangle at this position, and there's a specific call to do that. The next step is, having a variable hooked to something in what you're drawing. And that is usually the biggest leap, which is just like, okay, now one of these numbers, it is no longer 200. It is now var x equals 200. And when you change var x equals to something else, the position of the thing is going to move because these are all in a single variable.
So that's like algebra. And yes. Young kids might not even have algebra.
Yes. Yeah. So that's another issue. It's just like, yeah, we're teaching this. And that's one thing, one reason why it might be easier to a 15-year-old person, who's learning to program, because like they already have that underpinning of algebra. Whereas to young kids, we've had very young kids use our platform. There's certainly that challenge of being like, okay, well, let's teach you basic algebra now. One nice part about Khan Academy is that we have a ton of really good algebra curriculum. So we could do that. There are a lot of gotchas baked into that.
And then I'm sure there's a lot of like object is not a function.
Oh yeah. Exactly. All those like super cryptic errors that just like make no sense. It's very,
it's a lot to navigate around. Wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. And so, I mean, obviously that there are certain challenges inherent to using JavaScript as the introductory language as well. And we do certain things to restrict what you can write. One of the things I baked in was that I actually don't let them write the traditional function declaration syntax. So normally you can say function, get age, and then the parentheses and et cetera. What I actually do is I force them to write var get age equals function. And the reason for that is it's a subtle thing. One, you no longer have the extremely bizarre sort of hoisting mechanics that JavaScript has. So they don't have to think about that. You have to declare in the order in which it's going to be used. But the second thing is that it gets students to subtly start thinking about that JavaScript is a much more functional programming language. So because the thing is that when you declare functions and just say, function, the name, parentheses, etc., you tend to think of functions as sort of this weird entity unto itself. And whereas if you're assigning a function to a variable, you start to realize like, wait, I'm assigning a function to a variable. I just assigned 200 to a variable a moment ago, and I just assigned an object to a variable. All these things can just be put into a variable, and they can all just be passed around. Like if I'm putting X into an argument of a call to ellipse, maybe I could put a function in there. And what would happen if I did that? And so like that's a huge, really important leap that I find that a lot of people struggle with because they never got that initial sort of idea that functions are a thing that can really be manipulated and handled and passed around.
Very interesting. Is that something that you would advocate, if you were around on day one of JavaScript or whatever, you think it's something you would change in the language itself because it makes it so much more learnable or just it works for you?
I don't know if I would change that, but I feel like that's a technique that, I don't know. Cause the thing is that like, I've talked about this a little bit and there are a lot of people who disagree with me. I mean, obviously if I tried to, get this instituted, I would probably be shot down, but I feel like But the nice thing about at least the Khan Academy CS platform is that this is our domain. We can have that control and be like, hey, you want to declare a function? Well, this is the way you do it. You say var the name equals the function, and then that is it. Well, I mean, obviously, we'll probably talk about other ways later on, but we don't have to worry about that right now. You know?
Yeah. And you know learning, so. So that's Khan Academy. People can check it out, khanacademy.org, and then /CS if you're specifically interested in the computer science of it. But there's lots of other stuff there, like John said, math and all kinds of stuff. Growing every day, I'm sure. But you also work on, you said you spend a lot of your spare time building a site dedicated to Japanese woodblock printing. Maybe we could talk about that.
Ukiyo-e.
Yes. So that's something of my passionate side hobby here. This so for people who aren't familiar with it, it's this art form that kind of came up, you know, in the late 1600s in Japan. And what's most commonly recognized is sort of the Great Wave picture by Hokusai. Mm-hmm. You have the Great Wave crashing over, and it's ubiquitous. You see it everywhere, and it's this art form that I kind of stumbled across a number of years ago, maybe like 2009 or so. And I was just, I'd only ever seen sort of the Great Wave, and I'd never seen any other prints of this art form. And I started to look at them online, and I was just like, wow, these are so cool, so amazing, and so modern. They felt like they were made recently. But they weren't. They were like 150, 200 years old.
Well, it's flat design, really.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was just like a fascinating experience to be able to look at these. So like I just at a visual level, I just sort of became enamored with them. And, I just wanted to learn more. So I got books and, I was just reading about the prints. And as I was sort of going along, I realized that in order to understand I could understand them visually, but to understand what was actually in the prints, I essentially had to understand Japan. understand Japan during this particular period of time, 1600 to mid 1800s. And so again, it's just reading and reading and reading. And I have a bookshelf full of books now, just all about Japan during this time frame. And a lot of this is weird. For me that like, well, I love deep learning on stuff, but the thing is like, I never really studied history in depth, and I never studied art or art history in school. And so this has been very much a new path for me. Although I will say that I do now, really enjoy art, and art history. So one of the things I was doing in my studies is that when you're looking at a print and researching a print, one of the nice things about it is that it's a print. Inherently, there are multiples of them. They're mass produced. So with the Japanese woodblock printing, they carve a piece of wood, they put ink on it and put paper on, and they produce a whole lot of copies. And obviously not all of them have survived, but if you have a print or if you can see a picture of a print online, there's a probably good chance there's another copy somewhere else in the world. So this is something that I was frustrated with personally. So like during this time, I had started to acquire some Japanese woodblock prints. They're relatively very affordable. And it's one of those things that's like, I feel like grossly underappreciated. But one of the things that come up is that like, okay, like a print comes up at auction, and this happens actually very, very frequently, is that a print will come up at an auction, and the auction house has no one on staff who can read or translate the Japanese and figure out who that print was made by or what it's depicting. This happens everywhere. Essentially, there are only like maybe like three or four auction houses that can actually have paid staff that can do that. And so like what ends up happening is like this is an arbitrage opportunity. And so for myself, like, I'm like, okay, well, I see these prints coming out for auction, and it just says woodblock prints, lot of 12, $100.
Jackpot.
And I'm like, well, but the problem then becomes that for myself personally, that I can't read Japanese, at least not yet. And I certainly can't read Japanese calligraphy from the 1700s. So, mm-hmm. So this is, you know, I was getting all the books, everything I needed to read, the signatures and the seals, but it's still very painstaking work. Like to research a print, it was taking hours, if I was lucky. And so sort of my issue became is that, like, okay, this is really super frustrating. Like, I want to build a resource, a sort of a canonical resource that everyone can reference and have it be like, okay, if you're interested in this art form and these woodblock prints, you can go here and look at the prints and see them from all the institutions aggregated together and pour together into like one resource. So that's why I built ukiyo-e.org. But the thing is that I still have this problem, even with, you know, the aggregating all this stuff together, of like, how do I actually research a print? And I realized that since prints are multiples, that the process of researching could be severely improved by using computer vision techniques and doing image analysis of the prints themselves. So in this case, I built this tool. I aggregated all these institutions together. I have over 200,000 prints in this database now. And I did computer vision analysis across it so that you can take out your phone, take a picture of a print, and it'll look for that print in institutions and then come up with the matches. So the thing is that I actually do this. So like I go to auctions and I will look at what's for sale and I'll whip out my phone, take a picture of, and it just says like woodblock print, unknown, whatever. I take a phone, take a picture and it comes up and it's, you know, it's like, oh, this is by Kunisada from 1852. It's depicting this actor. And I can look at it and be like, oh, wow, this copy is actually pretty good. Or I could be like, oh, this is actually really faded. And like, you know, actually start to determine stuff about it. And I essentially, it elevates myself from being sort of an advanced layperson, you know, amateur, to like someone who actually is sort of an expert, you know, simply based upon the fact that I have this computer ability. And this is kind of tying back into what I was saying earlier about the importance of learning how to program when you have the other things that you're interested in. Because the thing is that like this field is extremely antiquated, extremely, extremely antiquated. Yeah. The people who are doing this, who are interested in Japanese, I'm easily half the age of almost everyone who's interested in this art form. So like, and the fact that I as far as I know, like I'm one of the only people who's actually doing interesting programming relating to it. It's giving me, I feel like a major leg up compared to where I was. Like I'm starting to compete now against people who have 30 years of acquired knowledge of going, you know, of dealing and all sorts of stuff. And I can start to go head to head with them. Now that's not to say that I'm only interested in like buying prints or like going to auctions and stuff, but I mean, it's the sort of thing where like I'm able to augment my knowledge where, and it's sort of a weird things are happening, which is like, you know, so at least for myself personally, people really know me for in the tech world for having created jQuery and amongst other things. So that, you know, that can, that sort of reputation can precede me. However, in the Japanese art woodblock world, there is no such thing as that. Like I've gone to many conferences and many meetups and stuff like that. And it's very, like no one knew who I was or cared. And what was interesting, a couple things that I found out is that, so I released the website in December 2012. And before that, I had like talked to a ton of people, done lots of networking, sending emails, gave out business cards, all sorts of stuff. It was like a very lukewarm response. December 2012, I released it publicly, got on Google, got it all indexed, everything, you know, using sitemaps, everything. And it was within like just a couple months that dealers started to contact me. And they were like, oh, I see what you're doing here. That looks super amazing. How do I become a part of it? And it was interesting. So like, just to give one anecdote, there's this conference here in New York called the Fine Print Dealers Association Print Fair. And, it happens every fall and you go to tons of print dealers and you can go look at prints. It's an awesome thing in general. And so I went, I've been three times, and I went, 2 years ago, and I talked with dealers, and I just gave them my card. I'm like, you should check this out. It's really awesome. And the response I got was, well, that sounds interesting, but it's not really for me. I'm an expert. But this could be interesting for lay people who are just kind of like learning. And like, this was super frustrating to me. And like, it's like, I was like, you don't understand. This can like completely change your field. And so like, I left that conference or that fair very, very frustrated. Like I couldn't understand why people couldn't see what I was doing. 1 year later, so in between then and the next next print fair, I released it publicly, went on the Google. Next print fair comes along. I have the dealers from the print fair contacting me before the print fair, checking to see if I'm going to be there because they want to meet and talk with me to make sure that they are putting up a good impression with me to so that I think of them favorably. So like I've gone in like the course of a year, I've gone from being like some schmo who has this thing, whatever, to being like an extremely well respected person in this field. And it's really weird. And like we're now, you know, like I'm getting recognized. I'm like speaking about Japanese art related things, completely divorced from my, JavaScript stuff. Yeah. I still haven't gotten to the point where I'm like reading or speaking Japanese. And the thing is that like people are starting to assume I know more than I do. Like I'm still reading and I'm still studying. But the thing is that like, you know, my brain is augmented here. you know, like I don't have all this knowledge built into myself. I can have this knowledge if I sit down with a laptop and like search around for a while. But like, it's a weird thing. And, but anyway, so this is sort of like a thing that I've been like, yeah, this is my spare time and a project that I've been working on, very passionately for, yeah, just, I guess over 2 years now. So yeah.
Are you listening, kids? This is how you level up in a hobby. 2 years. First, learn to program. Two, get famous in secondary field.
Yeah. John, I probably don't know this about me, but I majored in Japanese in college. And like, so I studied ukiyo-e and all this stuff like in college. And it was a nightmare to research online, like to just find prints. You know, you search and it's like the two most popular show up, right? So your resource here has been an absolute delight for me. So
fantastic.
On a personal level. So this is awesome. And yeah, I want to ask you about acquiring prints, but we'll take that offline.
So. Okay. I mean, I'm happy to talk about that. I'm sure people are probably also interested in sort of how I built this.
Yeah. People in the chat room were kind of wondering like what's on the back end of this here.
Yeah. So I've gone through a number of rewrites now. I'm on the third rewrite now.
And this is ukiyo-e.org.
Correct.
And we'll put a link in the show notes. Mm-hmm. You're probably not going to grok the spelling. So.
Yep. yeah. If it's easier, I also have woodblock.org, and that redirects to ukiyo-e.org.
Perfect.
this is a total tangent. Domain names relating to Japanese woodblock printing are very underappreciated. And so I've been, buying them off of domain squatters for relatively cheap. And getting them. So like ukiyo-e.org, woodblock.org, ahon.org, a whole bunch of these that are like actually like really good domain names for this field. And so like right now on Google, I think I'm like, let me double check. At least as of the other day, I was like third on Google. Yep, I'm third on Google for ukiyo-e. Let me search for Japanese woodblock print. And I am third on Google for Japanese woodblock print. So yeah, I'm like very, like, this is the sort of thing where it's like, I feel like it's a little bit unfair because the thing is like, I'm coming in and I'm being like, oh, basic SEO stuff. Like I can do that. And then it's just like, I just crush them and I feel a little bit bad, but like also it's like also kind of awesome. So,
no advantage yeah. you.
So. There's a guy who wrote a book called Shop Talk that was kind of not happy about us when we started.
Sorry, not sorry.
So the back end is Node.js. And so,
wouldn't have picked you as a Node guy, but go on.
So there are two parts of the back end. One is the scraping framework. It's all sort of that's the stuff that I use for scraping the websites and collecting data and extracting data from websites. And so that's a whole entity unto itself. The other thing with the actual website is Node.js. And I'm using, so the new rewrite I'm doing now, that is the backends with Mongo, the database, the data store is Mongo. The searching is all done through Elasticsearch. And the image searching is all being done through this tool, called, Match Engine, released, by this company called TinEye. The reason why I'm using this tool, one is it's amazing. It's a commercial tool. I haven't found a really good computer vision image analysis tool that's open source. At least right now, the TinEye people really love the work that I'm doing. So they're supporting, me using that on the UQA site, at least. I'm trying to think what else I'm using here. I mean, I'm using tons of different Node modules, to make all this, pull this together. And I'm also using, I'm using Express as the framework. Trying to think what else. At least right now, I have most stuff hosted in EC2. I'm in the process of transitioning over to DigitalOcean for some of this. And I'm also
previous sponsor of Shop Talk Show. Oh,
fantastic. They're great. And also getting, I have all the files, all the static files hosted on, CloudFront, the Amazon CloudFront CDN. So that makes everything load really, really fast. So one of the things that's been crazy about this is that I have a web, you know, this website, I released in English, and then I also released a Japanese version as well, which again is really interesting since I can't read or speak it. So that was a challenge unto itself. But the thing is that, like, I now have ja.uqa.org, which is the fully translated Japanese version, and I had to translate all the artist names, and all the text on the website. As a result of this is that I have more people visiting from Japan now than from the US. And actually the US is my third largest market. It goes Japan, then Europe, then the US. And so again, it's a really kind of weird thing that, like, you know, that I'm building the site that's ending up being much more popular elsewhere in the world.
That's cool.
Pretty cool. It's cool to know the stack too.
Almost all of it, I'm developing open source as well. So, like, if people are interested in checking it out, I don't have it all really documented simply because I'm the only person using it. But I've released a whole bunch of, like, Node modules, for example. Like, if you're really interested in, like, Japanese name parsing, which I am, I've released a couple Node modules that are all really good at Japanese name parsing, and I have those up on my GitHub account. So that's at github.com/jeresig, and I'll post that in the chat.
Sweet.
If you're just joining us, everybody, that's Mr. John Resig, who's talking about his work at the Khan Academy and the Japanese woodblock printing. And we were just talking about the stack behind his, let's just call it, we'll say woodblock.org, huh?
Or, yeah, we'll save you, Chris.
Okay. cool. So speaking of things that you might use to build a website, let me do a quick sponsor. We have Perch, for the first time as a sponsor. So thanks. This is, kind of the baby of Rachel Andrew, who we had on the show just last week, right?
Or maybe
2 weeks ago.
And we need to put that episode out, but we'll get on that. Go ahead.
Well, by the time you're listening to this, it will certainly be up. And so the URL for that is grabaperch.com. And it's, Perch, as they say, Perch is a content management system designed to help help freelancers and design agencies deliver great sites that their clients will love. So it's a CMS in that it has a back end with a UI and stuff, but it doesn't care. It totally doesn't get in the way of you. There's no like trace of the CMS when you're using Perch. You just use however you would have built the website anyway, and then inject the CMS-y parts kind of where you need to. There's no baked in HTML to fight against in a way. It's designed to be really fast. So when they can kind of pre-render templates, they do that. But then in the cases where it's actually kind of smart to use MySQL, they do, you know, for things like, I don't know, returning the sort order of something. That's what MySQL is for. So it uses that, you know, instead of, it's nice. So, they have actually a deal that you can use. So if you're, you know, Perch is it's a small business. They run it. It's a great CMS. It costs $79. Go buy it. If sometimes, you know, if you're having trouble committing to that, you want to try it out first. And you have your own portfolio site, or you work for a small agency and you want to make a site for them. If you go to grabaperch.com/deals, they'll give you half off. You just write to them and say, hey, I'd love to try out Perch. This is the site I'm going to use it on. And they'll give you 50% off of that. So check that out.
Awesome. Thanks, Chris. Well, we should probably jump into the meat and potatoes. But before we did that, I wanted to make a special announcement. Shop Talk Show is up for a .NET Award 2014. So head over to thenetawards.com/vote/podcast and vote for Shop Talk. All of these podcasts are really great. And some of these guys we've even had on the show. So, they're all great, but you know where your heart lies first. So do not disgrace yourself. I think is what I want to say there. So thanks everyone. And, we appreciate your votes. We appreciate the nomination. It's really awesome. You guys are the greatest. And then wanted to mention, Max Degterev wrote in, and we kind of were talking to him earlier about, you know, show us some stuff that you've done or what's cool and ways that you've leveled up. And Max sent in this thing he did over the holidays called instamap.me. I'll post a link in the chat.
Yeah,
room.
It's pretty cool. He used a bunch of technology that he had never used before to build a web app. He used Node and MongoDB, Browserify, Grunt as his build thing. He wrote all the JavaScript and CoffeeScript. So he just used it as this big learning experiment and built this like Instagram thing where you log in through Instagram. It shows all your photos around a map, and it's pretty cool. So thanks, Max, for showing us what you did. And hopefully you use Khan Academy too a little bit in there to level up.
Yeah. Well, I think the leveling up is what's the best. So awesome. Yeah. Thanks for sharing. So we got a
question here from Lasha Crick Kelly. And you want to play it?
It's an audio question. So I'm going to load it up here, and here we go.
Hey guys, do you think there's a clear distinction between basic front end development using HTML, CSS, CSS3, JavaScript, and jQuery, and then the other side of the spectrum with the emerging frameworks such as Backbone, Angular, Ember, and so forth? The reason why I ask is because I'm always kept busy with the first set of skills that I mentioned at work, and the other developers that are more comfortable with the architecture aspect of applications are always the ones that take care of that end. So is it worth it for me to start investing my time into learning these frameworks and building out these architectures myself? Or should that distinction remain in the front-end spectrum and just go about it that way? Thanks, guys.
All right. So is everyone
on board?
Within
the front end, there's this split. Do you feel that way, John, or do you have any opinions about that kind of
I don't know. I guess I tend to feel that, you know, even with these frameworks, you're still going to be, at some fundamental level, you're still going to be using these technologies. You know, you're still going to be using, you know, the underlying HTML, CSS, DOM, mm-hmm. etc. So, I mean, it's going to be important to understand and learn these things no matter what. And yeah, I don't know. I guess most of those, I mean, some of those frameworks are less, let's say, some of those frameworks provide less of an abstraction than others. For example, I would say Backbone doesn't provide too much of an abstraction
compared to some of the others. And whereas at the other end of the spectrum, you have, I don't know, stuff like React from Facebook, which is an extreme level of abstraction where like you are, not even writing a traditional HTML page anymore. So I don't know, like, I guess I feel like that there is always going to be room for learning, reading about and learning and understanding these underlying technologies, more so than going in straight into a sort of a mega framework.
Right. Sure. So nuts and bolts first kind of thing. But maybe at the same time, I don't know, there's no reason to not level up when you have the opportunity to, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, I don't know. One of the things that always worries me about frameworks in general is that developers, no one wants to think that what they're doing is trivial. Okay? So the thing is that the worst thing that someone can think of, like you see this a lot in mobile web app development, especially what people who are doing it with HTML, JavaScript, CSS, is that no one wants to think that their mobile web app is going to be super trivial to write. Everyone wants to think that their thing is going to be super complex and is going to require all the most interesting complex things out there. And so it's interesting because almost all, I'd say, corporate mobile apps out there can be reduced down to like a series of like lists that you're just going to like navigate through. And so you really don't need something very complex, and you can use something like, you know, for example, jQuery mobile. However, when people, you know, they're like, well, mobile, we got to go with the best and the biggest and whatever that is. So you end up, a lot of people are just inclined to go with the most complex, comprehensive solution, whatever that might be. And I think that is something that happens a lot with JavaScript frameworks, is that people, they don't want to think that their thing is going to be trivial. They want to think that their thing's going to be important and big. And so, like, why not just go with the biggest, craziest framework? Obviously not crazy, just let's say, most comprehensive framework. Because then they'll know that they'll never have to worry about anything ever again. However, the problem is that you're going to be worrying about, okay, like, I'm building these things that are, you know, perhaps way more complicated than they need to be.
All right. That totally makes sense. Let's do one more. Do you want to pick one out there, Dave?
Let's see here. Here's an interesting one. I'm curious to get John's perspective. So Israel Bautista writes in and says, I work as a front end developer at HipLogic. We are looking to fill a couple of front end dev internships. This is like a free job ad. But we would like to offer more opportunities to women in our field, but I have found it's extremely hard to find candidates. We have place our internships within the obvious places like schools and colleges in the areas and internships.com. But do you guys have any idea where I can find students who want to be part of our internship program? And I, John, you probably do a lot. And don't mean to like put you on the spot, but like any ideas here on how to encourage women and probably other minorities and underrepresented people to get involved? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a huge challenge, obviously. So that's something we struggle with at Khan Academy. We have a huge internship program, and every year we bring in last year we had 18 interns, and we only have, at the time, we only had like 20 some odd devs. So we're like doubling our devs force over the summer. it's very, I think at least at Khan Academy, there's one thing that works to our advantage, which is that our thing is a nonprofit and is education centric. And that tends to have a greater level of diversity than some tech fields. And especially, I was seeing a list recently of like, companies that have, what the diversity of their work, development team is like. And some things kind of really stuck out. It was surprising, but not surprising. I don't know. And I don't want to put companies on the spot, but like, for example, I think like GitHub, for example, was very undiverse,
and also that, like Stack Exchange had like almost no diversity. And so like it was, I don't know. So I guess it's just to say that like there is a lot of, a lot of it has to do with the field in which you're in and the audience you're trying to attract. But I'd say with us, like we do a lot of work trying to promote sort of, I don't know how I feel like this isn't really any different from any other company or shouldn't be, you know, just like, mm-hmm. like how interesting of a place it is to work, what sort of effect you can have on people, what sort of, you know, the sort of the tangible or intangible benefits. Whereas like, a nice part about Khan Academy is that we can be like, look, you're going to get emails from students whose lives you're impacting on a daily basis. And like, this is a huge thing. You may not get that as much at other jobs, but maybe that's something you can emphasize. I mean, like, look, you know, if you work here and work for our company, this is the effect that you're going to have. And this is the response you're going to get. And, you know, and that we're a supportive team that wants to help you. I feel like most of the things that you can do to improve, you know, diversity are just things that are going to help teams in general, you know, try to, be a supportive environment, encourage education, encourage, new development, working on new and interesting projects, you know, encourage, I can't think of another one, but yeah. So, I mean, it's one thing is that at Khan Academy, we have, we have a good dev team. I mean, we're not immensely diverse, but I think we have like 25% of our dev team are women. Which is pretty
sure,
good.
Better than average, I'm sure.
It's better than average. And I mean, we would love for it to be better. Anyway, it's the, and we do things like, you know, we have, you know, groups and meetups inside the, you know, the organization to talk about how do we improve diversity.
That's pretty cool.
There is a lot of discussion about this internally, whereas like, you know, it's a very real concern for us.
I remember at one time you made a big list, right? A Twitter list of women devs.
Yes.
That's pretty cool, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's been on your mind a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, that's something that I'm, you know, really passionate about. And I participated in an event recently called Code, is put on by this organization called Code Montage, where what they do is they try to get people involved with, nonprofits, contributing open source to nonprofits. And that's something that's really exciting. And at that event, it was one of the most diverse events I've ever been to. In every dimension you can measure. And I thought that was really interesting. And I find it kind of hard to extrapolate based upon that, but I have to feel like there's some aspect there that if you're building something that people are going to care about and are helping people in the world, in the nonprofit, even open source sense, that you're going to be attracting a more diverse audience. And I will prep, one thing I'll mention here explicitly is that open source on the whole surprisingly isn't very diverse, which is I feel really unfortunate. I feel like the context of what you are working on is mattering, a lot. I don't know if it's the biggest factor, but it might be.
I think that's good. I think the idea that you need to, you're kind of saying like create a culture of a positive culture, like through whether that's offering learning opportunities or even just customer relation or team dynamics. I think that has to help. But I'm curious, maybe I'm going to do a spin, but if, you're a woman or a minority listening and you have feedback, I'd love to hear from them, just from that audience, just because, you know, we're three white dudes talking about diversity, but I'm curious what other people kind of have to say. So
I feel like one of the things I want to do is just mention, so like, you mentioned that Twitter list I made. So I made a list of women who code. And I started with all the ones that I follow, and I asked for more to follow. And I've gotten just tons, just hundreds and hundreds. And it's been interesting. So like what I do personally is I follow every one of them because like at a personal level, I feel like I wasn't getting enough in my day-to-day experience. I wasn't hearing from enough different voices. And from different backgrounds, from different experiences. And I wanted to create an environment for myself in which it became much more expected that, that there are lots and lots of diverse, interesting developers out there. And so that's why I made this list, and that's why I'm following them. And it is interesting, like at least for myself personally, I found that it started to shift how I think about things. Because like, you know, I read Twitter a lot, like I'm sure a lot of people do. And, you know, so I'm kind of seeing these faces and these people and everyone talking about things on a day by day basis. And I feel like I'm starting to think about issues that I wasn't thinking about before. And it's the sort of thing where you have to put yourself out there and really, I think, you know, to try to take yourself out of your comfort zone and start mm-hmm. to really start, appreciate and understand and even just listen to other people and then hopefully start to make changes in your life and hopefully help other people.
That's a pretty cool. I like the idea of kind of compensating the other direction, like on purpose, because of your own natural bias or whatever. Mm-hmm. To kind of, you know, I'm just going to saturate myself with it because I wish I was more like it. It's just a nice sentiment, I think. Mm-hmm. I'm going to copy you. Speaking of a company that does a pretty good job with diversity at their conferences, our lovely sponsor, Environments for Humans, who are promoting their
These guys.
They have an online conference coming up April 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. It's a 3-day thing and it's online, right? So you can attend it from anywhere in the world. So non-discriminatory geographically. rwdsummit.com. You can go to any one of the 3 days if there's a particular day that interests you, or all three, or any combination of the days. Shop Talk Show, that coupon code gets you 20% off any combination of that. So lots of cool speakers at this one. Looks like Trent will be at it, huh? Looks like
yeah.
At least he's listed last. I don't know if that's indicative of the talking order. Actually, it is. They put their thing on there. He's kind of closing the show.
He's going to be the closer, man. He's the anchor. Is that what they call him? So
yeah,
I'll be there. I'm going to talk
nice
about tool sets and stuff like that. So yeah.
And Maul, Ren Lanier, lots of good people here.
These are all people you want to hear from. Jen Lucas. Ah, great. This is going to be fun.
Well, I love Jen. Okay, cool. So that's April 1st through 3rd, like I said, online. And it's like less expensive than a normal conference because you can kind of, you know, it's less expensive not only to attend, but you don't have to buy a plane ticket and a hotel and all that kind of stuff. You could buy it for your company. Does your whole company want to learn? Buy a group thing and, set up a couch in the break room and watch. Anyway.
John, can I ask you like the quintessential Shop Talk question, if you don't mind?
Sure.
It is, should I learn JavaScript or jQuery? could you answer this definitively, kind of seal the deal here?
So it depends. I feel like it depends. The context depends a lot upon what you're trying to achieve and what you hope the end goal is going to be. And
wishy-washy, you got to pick one.
Okay. If you're trying to just come in, build some sort of basic interactive thing on your website, and I'd say learning jQuery is fine. However, the asterisk there is that is all you're going to be able to do. And if you ever want to be able to do more, learning JavaScript is absolutely fundamental. And learning JavaScript, and usually what that question means, like, should I learn JavaScript jQuery, is what it's, you're sussing out a couple things here. One is the JavaScript programming language, the DOM in the browser, and then jQuery. Now, in my opinion, you should be learning JavaScript and jQuery, but not the DOM. So, like meaning that, like, if you're gonna do this, learn JavaScript, learn jQuery, do manipulation, you know, become really good at it. But, like, don't waste your time with stupid DOM nonsense. Like other people have done that. I've done that. Just save yourself the headaches and heartaches, and you don't have to think about that. So I mean, really, the answer is that, like, you should really be learning both. And because learning JavaScript is going to make you a better programmer, and especially a better web developer, and especially a better jQuery user. But the DOM is something you just don't need to think about.
I always like that funny sentiment that, like, you kind of maybe, you know, I'm putting words in your mouth, but maybe started jQuery because you're trying to get away from all these stupid browser bugs. And then jQuery grew up so big that you then kind of became the home of all these browser bugs.
No, that was exactly it. It was unfortunate. Yeah. Cause I wanted nothing more than to never have to deal with a browser bug. My explicit goal when I was first making jQuery was I was using Firefox in 2005, and I wanted to be able to write my web app and open it up in an Explorer and have it just work. That was the goal. And it didn't happen until I reached jQuery January 2006. Didn't happen until like mid 2006. And once that happened, I remember being so happy. Just so happy that, but again, exactly what you mentioned, like, once it was out there and other people started to hit other issues and I had to fix other browser bugs, now I was dealing with browser bugs that, I'd never seen before or never cared about, but, like, you know, now I had to deal with. Right. So yeah, it was, yeah, it's not ideal. But at the same time, now we don't have to think about them anymore. So, which is great.
Yeah. Less people think about them. Just yes. You have to more.
Yes, or the whole, yes.
The whole team. So you buy a horse so to plow the field because you don't want to plow the field, but then you're stuck shoveling crap.
Yes.
Good point.
All right. You want, John, do you have time for one more question?
Absolutely. Maybe? Absolutely.
Okay. Chris, do you got one picked out or are you?
Oh, I don't see. Know. I thought we were.
I can find one here. Beep, beep, beep. Here, this one's from Chris Omling, writes in, I'm interested in delving into the Canvas mini game space using JavaScript. Can you recommend a good place to get started? I'm a front end designer, developer, HTML, CSS, JavaScript, for about 6 years, knows DOM, creating web pages, but started on the artist side and not really a heavy duty programmer.
He wants to get into mini gaming with Canvas.
Interesting, interesting. So there are a couple different options here. Two of the ones that I like, at least as far as game sort of frameworks go, and I guess it depends if you want to do this in just the browser or browser and mobile or what. But sure. So I like pixi.js, pixi.js. And I also like, Impact.js. So Impact is really cool. However, it's closed source and costs money to use. So I will mention it, but just with that caveat. They are both designed to be able to work on, both in the browser and on a mobile device. And they're both designed to be able to support games and gaming constructs. I also want to do a shout out to this framework called Ejecta, which is made by the guy who made Impact, but it's free and open source. And what it does is allows you to bundle up something you've written using the canvas and deploy that as an iPhone app or iPad app or iOS app, whatever. And what is cool is it's essentially just a canvas, and it just goes straight to
OpenGL in the back end. And it's super fast. And it's like, it's a really nice way to use JavaScript to write essentially a functional game that could work both in the browser and a device like this.
That's great. That's an amazing answer. We're like, have you ever tinkered with mini gaming in Canvas? And you're like, all right, I got five perfect examples.
Yeah.
Yeah. One other thing that I want to call out, because I just ran across this yesterday, and I haven't had a chance to use it yet, is this framework called Node-WebKit. And essentially, it bundles Node into WebKit. So it allows you to do stuff like make a Canvas OpenGL game that is using Node libraries. So like one of the things I'm going to be using it for personally is that there's this library called Node Connect, and you can use it. You can plug in your Connect device from your Xbox into your computer. You can stream the data from the Connect into your computer. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to use Node WebKit to render a Canvas of the output. So I'll be doing manipulation on it and rendering it out. So this is, it'll actually make a desktop application that people can use, and it'll be interacting with the output from the Connect. So this is the sort of thing where it's,
The Connect is the camera and the.
Yeah. It's a little camera. A camera. It provides a couple of things. One is you can do, a video camera with color. It can also do a depth field. So it can tell you how far away things are. And using those things together, you can get some really interesting side effects. So I haven't fully explored that yet, but that's something that is exciting to me.
I hope it becomes a chat meet spaces pull request.
Perfect. Well, awesome. John, thank you so much for coming on the show. It absolutely inspiring. Really appreciate it. Before you go, though, what's one thing you kind of want to plug or make sure people do? And then how can people follow you, give you money? How does that work?
best way to follow me is probably on Twitter. Username is JERESIG. I tweet a lot. And if I ever write blog posts or anything, I'll put them there as well. And, yeah, I think that's probably the best way to follow along. If you want to give me money, you can give it to me. I'm on GitHub, GitTip.com/ I think
JERESIG or something.
Surprisingly, it's pronounced GitHub, which is weird. I was pronouncing GitTip until I met the founder of it, Chad Whitaker, and he's like, "Oh, it's GitHub." I'm like, "Really?" I'm like, "All right, fine." GitHub. I'm like, "Okay." So, but yeah, that's another.
I bet he calls it a GIF too.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right. Well, again, thanks, John, so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate it. Thanks everyone for coming down the chat room. You guys are great. Really appreciate you guys. And, thanks for listening, downloading this in your podcatcher of choice. Be sure to raise a 5 in your favorite little, store there. And also, hey, if you're listening to the show and you like the show and you want us to keep doing the show, give us a .NET award. It's just that easy. And, Chris, you got anything else you'd like to?
ChopTalkShow.com.